A former drug policy advisor to the UK's Labour government is in New Zealand to talk about how psychedelic drugs could help control a number of mental health problems and why the war on drugs is a failure. Professor David Nutt is a psychiatrist who has carried out clinical trials using LSD and psilocybin, or magic mushroom juice, to see how it affects the brain and why, in some cases, it helps relieve anxiety and depression. He was sacked from his advisory job after he suggested decriminalising drugs to reduce harm. Professor Nutt believes that alcohol is more dangerous than some drugs and has been holding a workshop in Christchurch on clinical management of anxiety and depression. He'll also speak at the University of Auckland on drug law reform tomorrow. He's with me now. And David, tell me, where did your interest in drug science start?
Well, it really started when I started doing medicine. I think I was always interested in the brain, but when I started becoming a medical student, and I saw how much my colleagues were drinking and how much it was affecting their brain. And then I went on the wards and I saw people fighting in casualty because they were drunk. And then I saw people having seizures and withdrawal delirium from barbiturates. I got quite interested in the way drugs change the brain and why people are so interested in them.
Yeah, so it started with alcohol for you.
Yeah, I think alcohol was quite remarkable when I saw my colleagues become very, you know, my student friends become extremely deranged after they got very drunk. It made me think, well, this is an interesting way of exploring brain function.
Mm. Hey, let's start with your stance on psychedelic drugs. Fairly bold stance, people say. You don't believe that they should be illegal.
Well, if you go back in history, they were seen in the 1950s and 60s as the great breakthrough in both brain science and psychiatry. There were 1,000 papers published. The US government funded 140 separate research trials. Most of the outputs were very positive. There were 40,000 people treated, and people thought this was a real breakthrough. One of them was licensed as a medicine. Psilocybin was licensed as a medicine. Gosh. Everyone thought, we're really making progress. And then came the Vietnam War. And young American men decided it was more fun or saner, you know, less risky to their lives to take acid and go and live in San Francisco than go to Vietnam and get killed. And the US government didn't like that. And there was an anti-war culture developing. They blamed LSD for it. So they banned the drug. And they banned all the other psychedelics as well, just for good measure. And since then, the US government has not spent a single cent. Not a single study has been done on psychedelic drugs in America.
Really?
None at all. And almost none elsewhere in the world. The British government's funded the one I did, but virtually no government has dared to do it because they're all so terrified of the American influence on the UN and the WHO and policy generally.
Does the United States still wield that much power globally when it comes to influencing directly or indirectly global drug laws?
That's a good question. I mean, one hopes that its authority has reduced a bit since they've now essentially given up on trying to curb the use of cannabis, both medically and recreationally in America. So I think their moral position has been weakened. But in practice, America funds the UN and the WHO, the majority of both their budgets. So it still has a huge influence. And you've got to remember, in America, despite the fact that 2/3 of Americans now have access to medical marijuana, it's still illegal under federal law. And the current government is trying to roll back that progress. So yes, I think the answer is America still calls the shots. And if it doesn't, by the way, it's going to get worse because it's either going to be Russia or China that call the shots. And they're even harsher on drug policy.
Really?
Yeah.
We'll talk about some of those issues in a minute. But, gosh, LSD, interesting, isn't it? You know, here we had the 1950s and the 60s, and it was going to solve the world's problems. We had literature come out of it talking about LSD and psychedelics, banned in 1967. So I suppose, as you say, the unintended consequence, David, is that you'd have all this body of research pre-67, but none after.
Yeah, you can see if you plot a graph of the LSD was discovered in 1943. The Swiss company Sandoz made it available for research in about 1952, and you can plot the number of publications on LSD, and they rise to a peak in 1967, and then it's made illegal, and then it just disappears. It's like Mount Everest, you know, it's a sort of doubling every year on year on year until it's banned and then disappears.
So you've done trials on the use of LSD and psilocybin, found in what's known as magic mushrooms, in terms of how it affects the brain. And your team, as I understand, was the first in the world to scan the brains of volunteers under the influence of LSD. Before I ask what happens, how did you get it to trial? How did you get the go-ahead?
Well, it wasn't easy. But in Britain, we have two separate regulatory systems, one which is more generous or less harsh on people wanting to do what you might call brain research, physiological studies, and then the one for clinical trials, which is much more stringent. And in fact, the Brain Research Ethics Committees were sympathetic. I mean, there's no question that the psychedelic state is a very important state. If you're going to understand the brain, you're going to understand the psychedelic state, because it's one of the more unusual and interesting states of altered consciousness. So actually, to study the brain science wasn't so difficult. To study it in the clinic was much more difficult.
So what happens then if you scan the brains of people under the influence of LSD? What do you see?
Well, this was the remarkable thing. And it's actually a very interesting story, in the sense that everything we have done has given us the wrong answer, so to speak. So we thought, well, people are having a trip, even in a scanner, they're having a trip. They're seeing coloured lights and they're feeling as they're floating through space and they're talking to God or aliens or whatever. And we thought, well, your brain would be turned on. You know the old adage, turn on, tune in, drop out?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that the brain is turned off by LSD and by psilocybin. And that was just such an amazing finding. And it was so bizarre that we thought we got it wrong. So we redid the experiment completely again, using a different way of measuring brain activity, got the same result. How can it be? How can you be turning off the brain? You have all these interesting experiences. And we're not entirely sure what happens, but we think it's like this. As you grow up from childhood, your brain becomes more and more systematized, more and more organized. Education development is all about making sure that your brain works in exactly the same way every time, every day, every second. And also works the same way as other people's brains. So when you say New Zealand, I understand you mean this country in the Southern Hemisphere, etc. So the brains become very, very, very rigid. And there are parts of the brain which control that. There are two parts of the brain which are like the control centres. And those are the parts of the brain which are switched off by psychedelics. So what we now think is that the brain becomes liberated under psychedelics. And it can do things which it hasn't been allowed to do since childhood. And so actually the colours you see are the primary processing of the visual system, which is normally you never see, because normally it's all built up to an image, a proper consolidated image. But the vision is, your vision is built up by a whole series of steps, which starts off being strange coloured lights. So under psychedelics, you can actually see how parts of your brain are working, things you've never been able to see before.
I think you've just blown my mind.
Well, there you go.
I haven't had any drugs. It's extraordinary. So you're saying under psilocybin, the brain can make connections which the brain hasn't been allowed to make since childhood. That is trippy.
Isn't it? And that's why people often get these phenomenal insights into what they've been doing wrong, or what people have done wrong to them. They see things in a completely different way because their brain becomes much more flexible, more fluid. Connections can be made which are not generally allowed to be made.
Wow. Well, let me tell you a little story, Professor Nutt. So in my Dunedin years, you actually get magic mushrooms on the hills there.
Uh-huh.
And my flatmate of one evening partook. I didn't, but he partook. He had magic mushrooms. He painted, while he was on the influence, a large canvas, and it looked like, a galaxy. And I said, well, that's an extraordinary picture of a galaxy. What galaxy is it? He goes, Wallace, that's not a galaxy. That's my doorknob.
Yes.
And that is what psilocybin did to his brain.
Well, it is allowing you to see. So, of course, at one level, the doorknob is a galaxy of atoms, isn't it? I mean, it's interesting how it just gives you that extra perspective. Now, of course, some people, like great artists, great composers, great painters, they often see the world differently anyway, and they I think they can't understand why the rest of us have such simplistic views of life. And it's under psychedelics that your friend was able to sort of become the new Van Gogh, really.
What about the therapeutic aspects of something like psilocybin or LSD? How it might be able to be therapeutic with regard to, say, depression? You've worked on this.
Yes, well, this is interesting tale. So we start off doing brain imaging studies in people who are normal volunteers, healthy volunteers. And then we discover that even though they've been given the mushroom juice in a scanner, they often come out saying, well, that was interesting, but also I feel a bit better. And they often said that sense of well-being lasted for a week or two. And there was a study in the USA by the John Hopkins group where they did the same thing. They took people who were interested in spiritual development. They gave them a single dose of psilocybin, the same dose as we give in the scanner, and people felt improved well-being often for months or years after, and said it was quite a profound and moving experience. So we thought, well, that sounds a bit like an antidepressant. And then we went and looked at our brain scans, and we discovered to our surprise that the part of the brain which tends to drive depression, it was switched off by psilocybin. And we noted that that was also switched off by other treatments like antidepressant drugs. So we wrote a grant, and that was the only grant we've ever been given to study these drugs. And I think we got it because depression is such a powerful and damaging disorder, and the treatments we have are not that good. So we did the study. We took people with resistant depression. They'd failed on two treatments, plus two drug treatments, plus also failed on CBT, and we gave them this one trip. With obviously preparing them for it and then debriefing them the next day after it. And the effects were dramatic. Some people got completely cured. Their depression went away quite rapidly and stayed in abeyance for weeks, even months. So it's a very powerful therapeutic effect.
Incredible. So that's after one trip. I was going to ask, would medication be a one-off intervention or would it be ongoing?
Well, I think the way we're using it at present is a one-off, but we're thinking that some people might need it, maybe need to top up. Some people might need it, say, twice a year to keep it at bay. We don't know if that would work, but certainly some people found that their mood was slipping back after 3 to 6 months. So I'm thinking a therapy. People might go perhaps twice a year to some nice place and have their mushroom therapy, you know, and sort of help reset their mind and get their depression at bay. Like you might go to a spa or even go on a holiday. You know? But rather than go skiing or go lying in the sun, you might go and have some mind therapy.
Good heavens. And it could be beneficial, as I understand it, for, say, cancer patients treating with psilocybin instead of opiates?
Yeah, so there's been two studies now that published about a year ago, but from two groups in the USA. We've known when we go back to the 60s that one of the most promising areas for use of these drugs was in helping people come to terms with dying. Because often under psychedelics, people become at one with the universe. They feel a sense of oneness. They feel a sense of their atoms sort of going out and being part of the rest of the atoms in the universe, which of course, you know, is what happens when you die. I'm very interested in that as a way of helping people deal with that terminal, difficult part of their lives. And these two American studies showed that it helped. The single psilocybin trip helped people basically come to terms, be less depressed, less anxious about dying.
And as anybody who has had cancer knows, or pain treatment, you know, opiates are certainly not the be-all and end-all, are they?
Well, that's one of the things that makes me pursue this line of research, because opiates, dying under opiates, you know, you're constipated, you're confused, you've got a dry mouth. You might be free of pain, but it's not necessarily a good death. And then, of course, there are all the consequences of using opiates to deal with chronic pain syndromes, where you get excessive use and perhaps people selling them on the streets or overdosing. So I think psychedelics potentially offer an alternative not just to the pain of dying, but also to potentially to treat pain syndromes instead of opiates.
Well, my question then, considering the work you've done, very, very, very interesting results, what's the time frame? Do you think there'll be a time where we're actually be able to go to a clinic and, as you say, pop a trip?
Well, you can now in the Netherlands, and you can do it also in Mexico, where they use ayahuasca. instead of psilocybin. You can do it in Peru or parts of Brazil. So people are, their health tourism to places where these are legal is happening. The sad thing is that you've got to spend a lot of money if you're a New Zealander to do that. And there's no need for that. All the government needs to do, and this is what I will argue, you just, let's reschedule them. They're in Schedule 1, and Schedule 1 says no medical use, which is, of course, a lie because they were medicines. So what you need, the government needs to do is put them in Schedule 2 alongside morphine, so they're not going to be distributed over the counter. But if they're in Schedule 2, doctors can use them, prescribe them, and also research them.
So the problem really is political, it's not medical.
Oh, absolutely. The problem, the drug laws are laws about, they're political laws. They have very little relationship to the reality of drug harms. In fact, they bear no relationship to the damage of drugs in Western society. So yes, they're not fit for purpose. And if, you know, if they were actually reducing recreational use of drugs, you might put up with them. But they're not. They're not stopping recreational use. They're actually making that worse, probably. But they're completely stopping research and therapy, which is outrageous.
We'll come to that in a minute, but I know what people will be saying this morning right across the country. What you're talking about, Professor Nutt, really flies in the face of what we might think would happen after prolonged use of psychedelic drugs. We may have heard of people who've had bad trips. We may have heard of people who've had nightmare trips. We might have heard of the Sid Barretts of the world who took a trip and never came right. What of those people?
We can say several things. The first thing we can say that those 40,000 patients which were studied, they were characterised pretty well, and the long-term consequences were relatively minimal. It didn't seem to provoke psychosis. Now, some people do become psychotic. Psychosis happens, unfortunately. Whether it's the LSD that drives it, or whether it's the cannabis, or whether it's the crystal or the pea in your case, we don't know. But people who become psychotic often try to find an explanation, and often they do focus on drugs. To be fair, I would not recommend the use of psychedelic drugs in people who've been psychotic or got a history of psychosis. But most people haven't, and it makes no sense to deny them from people who aren't going to be at risk to protect the few people who might be at risk, because in reality, you're not protecting those people anyway. If they're going to use them recreationally, they're going to use them recreationally.
I'm with Professor David Nutt this morning from Imperial College London, former drug policy advisor to the UK's Labour government, done a huge body of research on drugs and drug reform in its various guises. And your testing has included drugs like cannabis, also MDMA, ecstasy. The latter has caused a number of deaths. You say the fact that those drugs are illegal severely blocks research. I guess you can see the conundrum.
Yes, but the point is, if you look at the number of deaths, the drugs deaths in this country, and my country, and your country, tobacco is number one, and alcohol is number two, and heroin and opiates are number three, and they're scales higher than deaths from ecstasy, MDMA, which you might have three or four a year in New Zealand. Now, it doesn't make sense to say we're going to ban this drug because occasionally people who use it recreationally might come to harm. When you allow drugs which cause much more harm to be made available, and particularly when banning it means that people can't research it. I mean, that is truly the worst outcome. It doesn't stop people dying of it because there won't be any displacement from medical MDMA use to recreational use. But all the potential therapeutic value in medicine is being denied because you have decided to ban the drug. So it's a lose-lose situation, I think.
In fact, you do say, don't you, quite a strong quote, quoting you, that the worst censorship of scientific research in the history of mankind, there's nothing comparable in the ability to stop research.
That's right. So these drugs were banned in 1967. Some of them were banned in 1961. In the last 50 years, there's been almost no research. There's been no other area of science where research has been censored so uniformly around the world for 50 years. The amount of research opportunities lost in those last 50 years are vast, and the number of patients that have potentially been denied life-saving illnesses is huge. Can I give you an example in relation to alcoholism?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people don't realise that Alcoholics Anonymous was founded by a man called Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson had a psychedelic trip which stopped his alcoholism. He became convinced that LSD was going to be the way to help people break alcoholism. The American government did 6 trials. The effect of LSD, single dose, to stop people drinking is bigger than any treatment we have for alcoholism today. But the drug is banned, and it's been banned for 50 years. And in those, I've estimated in a very conservative way, probably 150 million people worldwide have died prematurely from alcoholism in those 50 years. Now, even if LSD only saved or helped 10%, that would be 15 million people whose lives were saved by using this drug. No one's actually no one's died from LSD. So you've got 50 million deaths because they haven't been able to have access to LSD, and no deaths prevented from stopping LSD. So it makes no sense to deny access to a treatment which could save so many lives.
It's really food for thought, isn't it, Professor Nutt? I mean, do you feel, you know, you, a person who's researched drugs and drug policy for his life, do you feel that you're sort of screaming into an echo chamber when you travel the world and you come up against governments and you think, this, we could do so much better, but it's all political. All the drug issues now are political, not medical.
Well, I do get frustrated, but the fact that you and I are having this discussion today shows we've made serious advances, because 10 years ago, this wouldn't have happened.
Really?
Well, yeah, absolutely, because scientists would be too terrified to go onto the radio and talk about this, and there wouldn't be the underpinning science. The great thing is now I can say to you, the science tells me how these drugs might treat depression or alcoholism. And that is very powerful, because now we can say it's not just hand-waving, it's not just Timothy Leary encouraging the world to change. We can say we understand how they work. This is a rational approach, knowing their brain mechanisms. And let's get on and use it. Because, you know, if we allow people to take morphine for pain control, which kills in my country nearly 2,000 people a year, it's irrational to deny people access to LSD, which kills no one.
Just out of interest, does each country, you mentioned morphine there in the UK, does each country around the world, or each city perhaps, grapple with different drugs? So it's, you know, heroin in one jurisdiction, it might be crack cocaine in another. Right now, for example, you know, we have a real issue with synthetic cannabis, methamphetamine. And does each country have its own issues?
Oh, very much so, yes. There are huge national variations. So in the UK, we have an enormous problem with synthetic cannabis, largely because our governments were stupid enough to try to test prisoners and other people for using ordinary cannabis. So they switched to synthetic, and now we've opened a Pandora's box. We have 70 deaths last year from synthetic cannabis in prison. We've never had a death in prison from ordinary cannabis. But the prisoners use synthetics because they can't be tested for it, therefore they don't lose their probation. So, yeah, countries vary. I mean, in America, there's a big problem with cocaine, crack and a crystal. In places near Afghanistan, like Pakistan, there's an enormous problem of heroin, but not a problem with cocaine or crack. You've got pee here because it's easy to make from pseudoephedrine, whereas you don't have cocaine because it's got to be imported.
What's the nastiest drug, in your opinion, or the drug that you just, you know, find absolutely no redeeming value?
Well, there are two major problems growing at present. Worldwide, unquestionably, the big problem are going to be the fentanyls, because the black market has now worked out it's way cheaper to make fentanyls than it is to make heroin. And you can make any powder turn into heroin by just adding a bit of fentanyl. But the trouble is some of these fentanyls are so potent. They're 10,000 times more potent than heroin. So the tiniest drop can actually be an overdose. So it's now become clear that about a third of the opiate deaths in America are due to fentanyl.
And wow.
That is going to sweep the world, because people have realised how easy it is to make fentanyls. And it's much harder to make heroin.
I just saw a recent documentary. In fact, we talked to the person on the show. You know, a policeman putting gloves on. This is sort of in the Chicago inner city district, putting gloves on. The person saying, "Why are you wearing gloves?" And goes, "Just so I don't get a drop of fentanyl on my hand. One drop, it'll knock me over." Might we see in the future fentanyl coming to jurisdictions like Australia and New Zealand?
You might. I hope you don't, because if you do, it's going to make life very, very unpleasant. How you deal with it is a difficult question. My view is that you've got to stop the black market dominating the drugs market. They don't care if people die. They're the ones that are selling fentanyls. You have to try. I think you have to have a Dutch approach, basically, where people have access to recreational cannabis, recreational drugs like ecstasy. They can be tested so that people know that they're not going to die. They're not taking something that isn't what it says on the tin. And that way people can be diverted to safer alternatives. And you get rid of the underground market of pee and heroin.
All right, so how far would you go legalising drugs? Interestingly, there's huge public support to go quite far on this, make cannabis legal. There's 100 million people in the world that can buy cannabis now legally. So what are your thoughts on legalising cannabis, but really legalising drugs?
Well, my position is pretty straightforward. We did a very, very detailed analysis of the harms of 20 different drugs, published in The Lancet in 2010, replicated by European experts in 2014. I'm going to redo that in Australia in April. But overall, we've now got a pretty good handle on the harms of each drug to the person. And my view is that a drug, or any drug, which is less harmful to the person who uses it than alcohol, should be available as an alternative to alcohol in a form where the harms are minimised. So that doesn't mean a free market. That doesn't mean opening up cannabis shops to compete with supermarkets selling beer. No. It means having access to cannabis and ecstasy and other drugs, perhaps like methadone and mushrooms, in pharmacies. Possibly with electronic cards that allow you to have a certain amount per year. Regulated access to drugs that are less harmful than alcohol will reduce the harms of alcohol, hopefully reduce the use of drugs more harmful than alcohol, like crystal meth and pee and heroin, and will actually overall reduce the societal damage from drugs.
You've had a very interesting relationship with the issue of alcohol, haven't you, really? I mean, the Home Secretary asked you to resign as chair of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, a prestigious position, after you said that alcohol was more dangerous than ecstasy or LSD?
Well, that's right, because in Britain, alcohol is now the leading cause of death in men and women under the age of 50. 26,000 deaths last year. Ecstasy, maybe 10. LSD, zero. You know, if we care about the harms of drugs to the point where people are dying, then you've got to do something about alcohol. And this is why I feel passionately about the position of science in this debate. Politicians lie about the harms of drugs like MDMA and cannabis and ecstasy, and because they want, I believe, to deflect attention away from focusing on the harms of alcohol. Many politicians get kickbacks from the alcohol industry. There's a huge amount of free alcohol swilling around our parliament, and people don't want to take on the alcohol industry, so they make a show of being hard on drugs by attacking people who use other drugs. And that's immoral. And it's also hugely wasteful to the taxpayer, because in Britain, and it's probably the same in here, in New Zealand, £1,000 of every taxpayer's tax goes on supporting the drinks industry the way we allow people to drink today. It's a huge waste of money, particularly for those people who don't drink at all.
They might have also seen, as some MPs have said, that they see the ravaging effects of young minds and young brains being impaired by pot. You know, or to quote Michael Bloomfield from University College London, THC produces complicated and sometimes apparently opposite effects depending on the dose, the age of the person taking it, and how often the drug is administered. Doctors potentially prescribing cannabis, he says, is a long way off.
Well, I can tell you that Michael is a colleague of mine, and he's on several of my papers, but he is not the world authority on cannabis.
Right.
And I would fundamentally disagree with him. The reality is that all drugs can be harmful in some people who are genetically predisposed and in people who use them excessively. I'm not ever encouraging anyone under the age of 18 to use any drug. I think that, you know, the longer you can wait before using any drug, the less likely you are to interfere with your education or your long-term health. I believe actually in Britain, one of the reasons we have this massive problem of early death from alcohol is because we allow our kids to start drinking heavily from the age of about 14. Half of all 15-year-olds in Britain are drunk at least once a month. It's underage drinking which is causing the biggest health problem. Certainly underage cannabis use would not be good, and I encourage people not to do it. But that doesn't mean we should ban it from people who would benefit and people over the age of 18 who are going to run into... There's very little evidence that if you start using it over the age of, say, 21, that cannabis has any enduring effects at all, and it may be actually quite beneficial.
You can aim at the media too, haven't you, in the UK, about attitudes to marijuana. Another factor, you say, is the Daily Mail. You single them out. The paper has had a major influence on the public debate about cannabis by violently opposing any change in policy, by, as I understand, using case examples of teenagers supposedly damaged by cannabis, and they do that quite often. So you've really got some media in your sights as well.
Oh, the media are often extraordinarily malignant in their approach to drugs and drug users. And newspapers like The Mail and The Sun, they almost take a pride in pursuing and promoting a public hysteria, moral panic about drug use, which is utterly unsubstantiated by the evidence. But they are very influential and they scare politicians. And those newspapers actually dictate the political agenda in Britain to a level which, probably more than in any other country in the world, our politicians are ruled by the media or by the newspapers. And they use drugs as a very easy target, because people who use drugs are often young people who don't vote and who don't read those newspapers. So I think the media attitude to drugs and drug use has been extraordinarily destructive and largely dishonest.
Professor Nutt, what would your advice be to the new government in New Zealand? What would you say to them?
Oh, you'll have to wait for Monday evening. No, I'm going to talk about. But no, yeah. I will tell you now. Why should I? We should hold it back. Not everyone can come to my talk. Mm. I'm going to say very simple things. I'm going to explain that the drug laws in this country are largely basically a mimic of the UN policies, which are largely driven by American policy. That policy comes from the Nixon era, where they're trying to wage a war on drugs for political gain. It comes from puritanical views, very ultra-conservative Puritans in America. It comes from the drinks industry trying to eliminate all competition to anything other than alcohol. And it comes from the media. And it's time that a rational country, you are an extremely intelligent country. You have a working parliament which has shown it can be world leading, the first country in the world, I think, to have female emancipation. You know, you've had, I think, one of the very first to have gay marriage, etc. You know, you're a leading intellectual country in the world. So free yourself from the shackles of the UN and the American and the Russian and the Chinese policy, which is the war on drugs, and do something rational. And the rational approach would be to, for a number of drugs which were medicines, like cannabis, like psilocybin, like MDMA, make them Schedule 2 so that your doctors can research them very easily and determine their therapeutic value in the New Zealand population.
You heard it here first. The challenge has been set for the new government. You heard it here on Sunday morning. Now, finally, David, before you go, back to alcohol. You've done some very interesting work recently on trying to mimic the effects of alcohol without the morning after hangover or the liver damage. So, you know, a drink that could get you drunk, basically, but safely. Will that ever be possible?
Oh, it's possible now.
Oh,
it's perfectly possible. No, we have discovered those ingredients to make that drink. We are very, you know, we are in a position to make available a drink which we believe will be very, very significantly less harmful than alcohol. It will not be converted to acetaldehyde, which is the toxic component of alcohol, will not give you hangovers. And we can, by very clever pharmacology, we can also minimise the risks of addiction and aggression. Oh, no, we're very far down that route scientifically. The big challenge is, will these drugs stay legal if you started to sell them? Actually, one of the reasons I'm interested in New Zealand, because you do have a more rational policy on drugs. You have what they call a Schedule D. I'm interested in the possibility that New Zealand might be a testbed for this less harmful alcohol. We call it Alcarel, because you're at least open-minded to the possibility of harm reduction for alcohol. So maybe in a year or two, if I get some proper funding, I'll be in a position to come here and have a drink with you to celebrate it.
Well, I'd love to share in a Bloodless Mary with you, David.
Good.
How extraordinary. What interesting research. Professor David Nutt from Imperial College London. It's great to have you on the show.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
And Professor Nutt's public lecture in Auckland tomorrow is at 6 p.m. at the University of Auckland School of Population Health.